Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. I have Cynthia and Sajid with me, and also our special guest, Richard Campbell. You've probably heard of him on Run As Radio, possibly even .NET Rocks. I would say that we are very lucky to have this podcast master on the show today. And, you know, he does a lot of podcasting, but he also works with conferences. I think he's a jack of all trades. And so I'll let him talk a little bit. Richard, why don't you give us some insight on how you actually got into the development space and how you became such a master podcaster, too.
Well,
that's just for me, though. I'm just being selfish.
Persistence is one thing, which I'm fairly consistent with. I mean, I wrote my first line of code in 1977. So
wow.
Just, you know, all right, so.
Me too.
Everybody else, nobody else was born that's sitting at this table in 1977. You were at least alive. Okay, yeah. So admittedly, I was 10 years old. So, and it was a microcomputer. It was a TRS-80 Model 1. It had a whole 4K of RAM.
Oh, wow.
And 4K?
Four whole K.
Wow.
Yeah, and a version of BASIC that was not made by Microsoft. It was actually a tiny BASIC.
And it was the more basic BASIC.
This was a very basic BASIC. It only had three error messages. What? How? And sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Is that true?
That's true. Yeah, that's the level one BASIC on the TRS-80 Model 1. Yes, yeah. What, so how, and sorry. If you think about it, what is object not found but sorry?
Yeah, all those error messages are too confusing anyways.
Yeah.
I'd rather have sorry.
I think they went downhill from there. They were really succinct back then.
But now it just gets more and more confusing the longer they get. Yeah.
But, I mean, and so the reality for me is I just was in first, right? I got lucky that I happened to stumble in that Radio Shack on that day with that machine, and it got me. You know, it was every night after school after that until I could save enough money to get my own, and I've never done anything else. I'm generation zero microcomputer, right, before pretty much everybody. So by the time I graduated high school, I was already, you know, writing code for a living. Like, I made money from that. Like, really never done anything else. What happened weird, like where all the podcasting and all the stuff comes from, is that explaining technology, telling stories around technology is its own thing. Mm. And it became profitable. Like, it's a good job, and most people struggle to explain those things well. And so if you can understand things and then put them in the language of the people that need to learn them, you can do a lot. And that, if you really look at everything I do, whether it's working on startups or making podcasts or making conferences, or it's all the same thing. It's storytelling. How do you tell the story of a technology well?
Do you think that a lot of that comes from your own knowledge of technology and then like continuous learning to tell the story, or do you think it really feeds off of other people?
I think you need a grasp of the technology, and you have to be interested. But you discover things about yourself. Like, in high school, I was the behind-the-scenes guy. I'm good with electronics, so I fixed all the stage gear. And I never wanted to be an actor or a musician or anything like that. I'm perfectly happy to run the stage. But later in life, when I was, you know, working in the industry, and I needed sort of evidence that I was making original science. And so, like, making presentations was a part of that, right? We were writing code, and I wanted tax credits for it. And so, I'll see if I can get myself into a presentation. I got on stage, and I talked about, I think, reporting systems. And I got that big round of applause and went, oh, I like that.
This is nice.
And not everybody reacts that way. Mm-hmm. You know, some people are, I mean, it's not unusual to be horrified to get on stage. That's a fairly normal reaction. But if you get the rush of, you know, engaging an audience, and that really does something for you, well, then, you know, then it's worth doing more of. And I certainly got smitten with that. And so just learned how, you know, it's a science. You can study it. You can get better at it. You can take it seriously. And I did, and enjoyed it. And then, you know, from that comes this, oh, it turns out I love the stories. I mean, and part of storytelling is both collecting the stories as well as telling them. And So you think about what we do on a podcast. Well, what are we doing? We're collecting stories, right? Mm-hmm. And helping to reveal them. Often our guests struggle with just how to tell that story themselves. But if you can get them comfortable and the things that inspire them, well, you get a great story.
So how do you tell the cloud story to somebody? If somebody, you know, maybe a kid or someone
who or your grandma. How would you explain? Grandpa, you know, how would we explain or tell the story of cloud to our grandma?
Of other people's computers? You know, I think the broader statements about utility computing, which, you know, once upon a time, we collected our own water. You know, it was up to us. And then as a tribe, maybe we dug our own well and we shared the water. And those grow into cities and plumbing systems and so forth. How does an essential resource become commodity or become utility? And that's where we are with computing, is that computing is no longer optional in modern society, and we're transforming it into a utility where you consume what you need when you need to. And it requires a bunch of things that seem new, but are not as new as they seem. Like, you can't make cloud without internet, which means you need ubiquitous networking, right? And ubiquitous Wi-Fi. But then to be able to centralize that compute in a place where the best can operate it on your behalf and you can consume it when you need to, it's exactly the same as water. It's a utility.
You know what I think is so powerful is that because of I know that you're telling the story of the cloud, but in telling that story to us on this podcast, I know there's going to be other people that take that to their customers and explain the cloud the way that you just did. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is amazing is, you know, Microsoft's democratizing so much in the cloud, AI, you know, we're having all these conversations, but by having the conversation on this podcast, we're then democratizing the story. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, I just love what you just shared because that's the power, I think, of the podcasting is that gave me a new perspective on how to explain Azure and compute.
It is indeed all about perspectives. Yes. Yeah. You know, it's how you view, that's Richard's view of cloud computing, which he put very nicely forward. But, you know, how did that, like, you know, you've seen it all, right, from the TRS-80, I think, mm-hmm. is that what you said?
Yep.
The early computers. And now there's no computer. It's somewhere in the cloud.
No, right? There is always a computer. It's just that it's not important.
It's not important. Right?
Like, ultimately, they were never important. That's right. The joke. Actually, there were other things we needed to do, and they facilitated. And the question is, how far did you have to go out of your way to be facilitated?
Right.
And what we're getting to expect to not have to think about that facilitation.
But how has it been difficult to kind of make that transition, especially from your the journey that you've been through, which is like, you know, an extreme journey, right? From mm-hmm. having played with the bits and, you know, cracked open, maybe built your own computer all the way to now where you don't have to think about it. How did you have to reinvent, you know, your basic thought process around programming and writing applications and what a computer can do?
Well, multiple times. I mean, that's sort of reality of being in things. And that's why people step off. It's like you get to a worldview that you're comfortable with and maybe you don't want to change that worldview anymore. And so you can ride that as a career for a long time. You know, if you got into web development in, say, 2002 when .NET was brand new, and you started with web forms, which still exists today. So you've now built in web forms on the .NET stack. It's the only stack you know for 17 years. That's not a bad career all by itself. And it's going to keep functioning for a while yet. I mean, people are a little worried because web forms is, you know, getting longer in the tooth and Microsoft's not choosing to move it forward with core. And there's a bunch of good reasons why that's true. But you can execute a career around a stack. I still meet COBOL developers once in a while right now. Most of them are in their 60s and they really want to retire. And they're being offered so much money.
They're very valuable.
They're so valuable.
Resources, because you can't find any.
Because they're so rare. And so they're working later in life because it's just like, I'd be stupid to turn away this money. But at the same time, I'm working on the project to please make my job obsolete because I would like to retire. Right? So it's interesting to look at those different stacks. Now, I'm not that person because I am fascinated with the new thing. And I have rebooted my viewpoint on software multiple times over the year and enjoyed it. Like, that to me is delightful. It's not everyone that likes that, but I certainly do. And I had good mentors, you know, early on, much more the engineering mindset of how is this providing value, this return on investment in technology. And suddenly you're a little more agnostic to what platform you're working from. Now, I mean, I also had the good fortune to get in early enough that I watched hardware change constantly and operating systems shift. And so you weren't, there wasn't one great solution. It depends on where, I think it's because I came in early enough where there was an IBM PC and a Mac and an Amiga and an Atari ST and like there's all these other kinds of computers. And so we were always in this heterogeneous world. The homogeneous world of the sort of Wintel hegemon only really comes along in like 99. Mm-hmm. And then when the iPhone comes along and you know, now the super, we all have a supercomputer in our pocket, right? We take it for granted. I did the math the other day, and a Cray XMP from 1985, which was the most powerful supercomputer in the world, it had 2 gigaflops of processing power, which is the same as an iPad 2. Right? That's Moore's Law in action, right? From 85 to 2011. These phones we've got are many times that. And we just forget, like, this is a PC, this phone, right? Mm. It's the most personal computer in the world. It's in your pocket, for crying out loud. You're afraid it's going to give you cancer. What's more personal than that?
One thing that's fascinating to me, too, is just the way that the hardware that is running in the cloud is becoming so freaking fast and powerful. You know, yeah. Like when we talk GPUs and stuff, seeing some of that to me blows my mind because...
Well, and it's a specialization that individual organizations, much less people, couldn't afford to do.
Right.
Right. It's only at scale that suddenly it makes sense that we would have dedicated hardware for particular kinds of workloads.
Yeah.
These, you know, the Saturn clusters that NVIDIA builds. That I don't know that any company owns those. It's just the cloud vendors that do.
Right.
And it's just, okay, you know, this is the upside to scale. Right? And I would even still equate this back to water. The way that we treat water at scale is very efficient. We would never do that at home.
Right.
And yeah. Then we're doing that with cloud computing, where we can build specialized machines because you get sufficient utilization for it. Mm.
So I think what you were trying to say earlier is that now we don't have to worry about that. We kind of solve other problems because that commodity equipment is already there for you. What are these other problems that, you know, we can, like, solve? And you know, maybe they're real world problems or commercial problems, but what are you seeing out there that kind of lights up as a result of this commodity that's available to us in the cloud?
I think the biggest thing we're getting from cloud as it matures and we start building real stacks upon it is utilizing the data we already gathered. And it's been a good career for 20 years now when OLAP and analytic tools first came along. That if you could actually go and just mine value in the data that companies had already gathered, you created new lines of business, you created huge opportunities, you got yourself a promotion. It just was really hard. You know, in those early OLAP days, the Ralph Kimball days and stuff, you were basically making a multi-million dollar bet that you were going to find something because you had to buy so much gear to build out something that would look like a data warehouse that could actually organize data well enough that you could get something useful from it. Today, it's a switch on Azure. You can run it for a few hours, and if you don't like it, shut it off. And you've spent $100. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we can do that experimentation now, that, you know, you call it democratizing, I would call it commoditizing, right? That we're making it staple. It's easy. It's inexpensive.
And available to everyone.
And it has a gentle learning curve. You know, the immature technologies have very steep learning curves, and so only experts can dive into it, and only pioneers will experiment with it. Flatter learning curves allow more people to enter. And actually, if you look at the history of Microsoft, it's what they've always done, is flatten the learning curve out so that you don't have to know very much to do a little more and do a little more and do a little more until you reach that expert level.
How did you get kind of so close to Microsoft? You've always been kind of close to them on the periphery. What was your first entry point? And you've kind of stuck out there for a long time then.
I wasn't a Windows fan at the beginning. You know, again, we're talking in the 80s, so I thought...
Just like Doors.
Yeah.
Had to.
I don't like Windows, but I like defenestration. How's that? Like, I'll throw you through a window, but not the same thing. Well, I thought taking your hand off the keyboard to grab a mouse was the stupidest thing I'd ever seen, right? Like, what? Why would you do that, right? Like, are you kidding me? But I'd been typing for a long time at that point, and I was writing software at that time where counting keystrokes as a measure of efficiency was the most important thing.
Yeah.
And you want to do what with your right hand? So actually what attracted me to Windows finally was the print driver. That was the most important thing. Because before Windows, every piece of software you bought came with more disks than the product of drivers. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually made money off of, you know, doing an inventory of what apps this company's going to need and figuring out what printer would work with all of those apps.
Wow.
Because each app had its own driver set, and it was this giant Venn diagram of hell to finally consolidate. It's going to be an Epson 800 because that's the one printer that everybody supported. But then Windows came along and said, oh, we're going to own the drivers. Like, that was a profound moment where it's like, now software doesn't, your apps don't have to have the drivers in anymore. It's like, okay, I'll put up with your stupid mouse to get that driver problem. But then the discoverable interface was a very, you know, instead of memorizing keystrokes, you had the tooltip. Very profound. Like, now you're looking at where how software works. You can discover new things in software. It's not the click on the mouse. It's where you hover the mouse. Very interesting way mm-hmm. to think. But we're still at the beginning of what the cloud's going to do for computing.
Yeah.
Right? The same way that we were making fun of the mouse at the beginning. Because why would you do that? It's like, why wouldn't you own your computers? Are you crazy? Like, what? And initially it becomes a financial thing of, oh, okay, like now, I mean, I've spent years in the business of building out a data center for a company. Every 4 years we're rolling over hardware and we start spacing it out over individual years and measuring warranties. And it's not the business of the company, right? It's this necessary plumbing of the mm-hmm. company, and we spend a lot of time on it. And so the fact that I always get the newest hardware from you by the minute, that's a pretty compelling part. And it's not even the good part. Like, that was the easy sell. The CFO understands moving from CapEx to OpEx. Like, mm-hmm. we can get that sale. But when we start re-architecting our software to work the completely different way, that, you know, I used to do reconciliations of my accounts receivable once a month because it's hard. It takes time, right? You've got to go through everything. The fact that you can reconcile everything at the end of every day or even hourly can do reconciliations so that we're looking at moment-to-moment sales numbers that are still correct, right? Unreconciled numbers are not correct. And so, you know, we would be careful not to look at the current day because it's incomplete. But it's too hard to compute it more accurately than that until we automate all of these things. And so we have that. We don't think about it anymore. It's kind of trivial that we have continuous reconciliation.
So kind of following up on your comment on we're really in the beginning of the cloud mm-hmm. or this whole journey, where do you think for someone that just started should start looking at? Like, what is the easiest entry point to start on that really flat learning curve?
Now, are we talking about someone who wants to expand their career or an organization that's looking to utilize technology? Because they're two very different
Or somebody out of school maybe or college?
Or like both. Yeah. One for like people that just want to learn for themselves and really wanting to explore and know what are all the capabilities versus like customers that are trying to advance their businesses and see how they can take advantage of the cloud.
The company one's easy because you have a pattern of how you buy equipment anyway. And so what you're really looking at is what gear is going to expire next that I don't want to replace. And those should be the projects that I start looking at moving to the cloud, right? And you're going to deal with some governance issues. I think most of the big cloud companies have resolved those well enough that you have answers for any auditor that is concerned, regardless of industry. And I'm even talking tough ones like financial services and healthcare. It's like those things have kind of been pinned down now over the past few years, where it's like that's not an excuse anymore. So you look at the workloads that are going to age out first, and you look at the new workloads that need to come in, and you build a gradual transition, right? I think hybrid is forever. You're never going to turn everything off,
right?
And so just embrace it. You know, well, and the big problem is that most people look at hybrid as temporary, and so they're not taking it seriously. And it's like, no, it's forever. So build the test infrastructure around it, build instrumentation around it, because it's not going to go away. And that's okay. That's fine.
We need to get rid of the mainframes, but hybrid will stay.
Yeah. Yes. You know, Fujitsu still sells the Skyline. Right? They're good machines, actually. It's just a question of what you run on them. And the new versions of the IBM 360s are running a different operating system. Like, big iron actually in some ways makes more sense today when you think about it from a cloud perspective, where you don't actually, you're sharing load on the machine anyway.
Right.
But it's just a question of, do you still want to pay for that room, all that cooling and that air conditioner and so forth? Let somebody else do that. Like, it's not actually your specialty in your company. Maybe it is, but if it isn't, then don't do it.
I have a question on that. I know Cynthia asked about how would just the everyday potential, you know, potentially a student or just people that are new to the cloud. Mm-hmm. But in terms of migration to the cloud, what do you think about disaster recovery being a strategy for how people start to venture into the cloud?
I think it's a good one. And I've certainly worked with customers where we were going to build a backup data center and decided to make the cloud the backup data center rather than pay for that. Although architecturally it's different, right? And it's very hard to make a hot failover to cloud. It's easy to do a warm failover to cloud. And so we certainly went down that path. And then at some point you just think, well, what if we try switching it on? Because, you know, no strategy works if you haven't done it.
Right.
And so then you do it and go, wow, this thing runs really well there. Why would we put it back? So yeah, I do think DR is an entry point from an IT perspective.
Okay.
Right. Where existing software migrations are more of a dev a view of that. It's just that often DR stuff isn't close to expiry. And for me, more I tend to look at the financial side where it's like we're 24 months away from spending a 2-comma number. If we take a piece of that and do this exploration, we can make that number much smaller. Mm. We're not going to have that big commitment.
So there's more of a business
and that wins the CFO.
Proposition. Yeah.
And when the CFO is on your side, he'll beat everybody else up for you. Like you'll get a long way from that.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the things that software people avoid. Is, you know, there is a dollars and cents side to this thing.
I think that's a valuable, I appreciate this conversation because I think it is valuable for customers who are trying to figure out what is my pitch to the rest of the company mm-hmm. as the strategy for getting to cloud. So I think that's relevant. I'm glad that you shared that.
There's more complex stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like when you actually get good at cloud and you're running major workflows of an organization through that, you can price product differently. You have different levels of confidence and reliability. And suddenly you can sell your product in a way that nobody else can sell it, that your competitors can't sell it, because you have a higher uptime. Like you can guarantee delivery on stuff rather than just do piecemeal. Like people want those guarantees.
And you also have a lot more data about your
customers. Yeah, your metrics. That's like, what I was just about to say. I mean,
and all the analytics you can run, all the AI you can run.
That you didn't have to build. Like you could have done that. You're just never going to get to it. Right.
It'll take a couple years, and then what you're building is obsolete, and then you start building the next one, and then it just keeps going. It keeps chasing this train that you never get to.
Well, there's no organization in the world where IT got to the bottom of the to-do list. Like, it's impossible, right? And which is also where it gets into this ridiculous joke that's like, I'm going to lose my job to the cloud. I'm like, really don't think so. Like, if all you care about is spinning screwdrivers, yeah, you got a problem, okay? But if actually what you care about is the stewardship of information technology inside of your company, yeah, you're never going to get to the bottom of that list because there's always more to do. You can always get the organization better at it. But the idea that you could get to a place with these architectures that allow the company to discover new products that they can sell to existing customers or to open new markets, that's a much broader way to think about it. And it's still actually IT. You're still doing your job. They just didn't think that way.
What do you think about people who they want to be into this space, they want to be able to do it, but it takes time and effort to become someone who understands the cloud, understands the services, and it is a daily job staying up to date with what is happening. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, the trick is narrowing your scope to a place where it's manageable. The one advantage you've got if you're starting now is nobody has 20 years of experience with the cloud.
Yeah, right? That's so true.
So that whole piece goes away, right. And even newer technologies, like a lot of the new machine learning stuff, which is even though we've done versions of ML for 20 years, the kind of ML we're doing today is completely different. And so nobody has a huge pile of experience in this. They may have done a bunch of things related to it, and so they have background on it, but modern modeling is very different. And actually, and something I talk about occasionally on my show too, it's like sometimes that experience, that scar tissue that you've got from all the battles you fought over those years are actually holding you back.
Yeah.
That often someone coming in new and just believing what this new technology can do and running with it. It's like they're running with scissors. They just don't know they're sharp, right? And then it turns out, the new scissors have guards. You can't hurt yourself. It's all these years I wasn't running with scissors. I had no idea. It couldn't hurt me anymore, right? So there's a power to coming in new and fresh and willing to learn the new thing and then just doing those experiments that a lot of others are going to hesitate to do.
I think that's a big part of it, honestly, is there's this fear of, I need to understand all of this before I get hands on keyboard, before I spin up the VM, before. Right. And it's like, no, you just have to jump in. You have to get over your, you have to get through yourself feeling like I don't know enough.
I'm sure Richard's experienced this with the fintech companies, right? They're the guys that fear the cloud the most.
Well, yeah. they're deeply
fear
regulated.
Of the unknown yeah. kind of thing.
And again, there's also a strong incentive in financial services to not be the one that challenges the auditors. And so you're always, it's like, change is good. You go first.
Yeah.
Right? Like we're always looking to who is the one who's going to be able to actually figure that stuff out. And, you know, organizations like Microsoft often step up and they're the ones who've actually gone through the audit and said, okay, we're qualified to do this. You're allowed to do these things. These kinds of transactions can live in the Irish data center. You know, for elsewhere in Europe, like those kinds of rules can be explored. But there's a reason those organizations hesitate and move very carefully. At the same time, there's still competition in that business, and you can outcompete others with using more modern infrastructure, like actually taking advantage of what the cloud can do, that it doesn't matter where you are. But there is no such thing as an outage anymore. We have redundancy across all these different systems. But
so when you talk about all these global systems, I know something that you've talked about before is, it's always some ambiguity about who owns the data. Where does the data reside? You know, is it really lawfully here or there? Because our servers are all over the place.
And what do they want?
Yeah.
Right. And again, often people are afraid to even ask the auditor because the auditor might give them the wrong answer. Right. But you think about what an actual transaction looks like, and it's at least three pieces. Right. It's where the keystrokes took place, where the computation of those keystrokes took place, and where the data was stored. You know, once upon a time, that was one machine. But not in the cloud. You know, if you're using Cosmos DB and you've got a set of containers, like you literally could be working across multiple data centers. You can make specifications around that, but it's not required. And it's also not important. So it's one of the challenges when you're dealing with regulatory bodies is to go with them. It's like, you know, what makes sense there? I dealt with issues, this is a few years ago, where with encryption. We're like, well, we'd like the transactions to be encrypted end-to-end. So when you say end-to-end...
which end to which end?
Yeah, where's that end exactly?
Where does the cloud end exactly?
Yeah, where does it end exactly? So, this, you know, we were using F5 Big IP, right? Like SSL and edge devices. So they were encrypted to the point where it exited the internet and went into the internal network. Is that end-to-end enough? Because we are going to go across a couple more devices unencrypted to get to the machine. And you might say, oh, well, maybe we should leave it encrypted till it actually gets to the machine. Okay, gets to the machine, but it's going to go through several different processes inside that machine before we're really going to need to look at the data. Like, do I have to keep it encrypted until it literally gets to the process that's going to read it and then decrypt it? Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? And the documentation says, you know, the specification for the regulation says end-to-end.
So then there's also this huge paradigm of a lot of documentation or a lot of regulation needs to be modified now that the cloud is a whole new concept.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm not saying it's beyond them. I'm saying it takes a lot of work. And the fact is, in the process of developing documentation like that, which easily take a couple of years, we change what we're doing anyway.
Yep.
You know, if you started working on new regulations around financial services for the cloud in 2011, when we had AWS and Azure, but not Cosmos DB.
It would be different than...
Totally different, right? So,
can I add something really cool in here that I found a couple of days ago? I know this is a new update, so I just feel like I should interject it here. So we mentioned containers, we mentioned Cosmos DB. So now the etcd API is available in Azure Cosmos DB and basically lets you use Cosmos as the backend store for Kubernetes.
That is cool.
I'm sorry. That's so cool.
That is very cool. But
you know, when you get serious about building out packages for containers, like your central hub becomes large.
Yeah.
So I think this is the beginning of how we build. If I had a global organization, like I had a global organization, where I need to scale on demand anywhere. And I'm not just talking about a CDN. I'm talking about standing up instances of an app localized to a location on demand.
Yeah.
That's the kind of infrastructure you're talking about. That I could literally be able to, 60-odd Azure data centers. Right. And I could see if there's a sudden burst of demand for this particular website in Brazil. And just say, all right, well, we'll just run the site from Brazil now while that load goes on. And be able to pull all those instances and automate that scaling. That's... I mean, I like Kubernetes and Orchestrator, but dude, that's next level orchestration
right.
you're doing there. Yeah. Like, holy like, cow.
Cosmos is, I think, I mean, I could geek out about Cosmos.
Yeah.
I love
Cosmos.
I really do.
Well, talking about geek out, I know you and Carl occasionally do these geek out sessions.
Yeah.
And I have a geek out kind of question for you.
Okay.
Quantum computing.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we're starting to see more stable qubits. We're at a time in quantum computing that is more like the 1950s to me, where there were a bunch of people building computers, but we hadn't standardized on the transistor yet. So we haven't standardized on how we store a qubit. And so there's like a half a dozen different mainstream strategies for making a qubit. Microsoft is hooked on the fermion approach, and we can debate whether that's a good idea or not. There's some pluses and minuses to it. You can talk about the D-Wave guys with quantum annealing, like that's another approach. There's a variety of these. So here we are trying to build computers. We don't really have a transistor nailed. And they built a ton of them in the 1950s. You know, that's where UNIVAC comes from and the Sperry Spark. Like there were some cool machines there. They're mostly in museums now.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but one of those machines was the IBM 1401, which is the beginning of what would become the mainframe. Right. We just don't know which one it is.
But as a concept, though, quantum computing, do you see that having that potential to really make? I mean, the promises of quantum computing are outstanding.
Yes, but and I think the cloud's an essential part of it because odds are we're not going to own one. A, they're finicky.
Right.
And B, we don't need them all the time. And they're going to solve certain classes of problems. And like one of my favorite ones is the nitrogenase problem, right?
It's the which problem?
Nitrogenase.
What's that?
I don't know what that is.
So nitrogenase is a particular enzyme that fixes nitrogen in plants. It actually lives in a bacteria that grows on certain classes of plant. So if you are in agriculture, you know that you need to rotate crops, right? You grow wheat one year, you grow beans the next year, you'll grow a leaf vegetable the next year, and then you go back to wheat. Why? The wheat takes nitrogen out of the soil. The bean puts nitrogen back in. Now, that's weird. Why would it do that? Because the bean naturally has an occurring bacteria that collects nitrogen from the atmosphere, combines it with hydrogen to make a kind of ammonia. And then when the plant dies, it leaves that nitrogen in the soil. Now, the way that it does that is with this enzyme called nitrogenase. Now, we know how to do that industrially, right? This is the Fisher-Bosch process, if I remember correctly. That was invented outside of World War I, and it allows us to, industrial scale, make a fixed nitrogen for fertilizers. It's also good for explosives, too, which is why they actually develop it. No, that's a secondary issue. But it's an expensive, high energy. There's an argument it's 1% of all energy consumed on this planet is making fertilizer. Which is fine. We got to feed a lot of people, but it's just like this is not a trivial thing, and this plant does it without any heat or electricity, quietly in the ground. Now, lots of people have studied this problem. It uses some molybdenum, it uses some iron, but it uses some catalytic reaction to make ammonia without all that industrial process.
And if we could reproduce that,
we haven't been able to figure it out. There's enough electrons involved in all of those particular atoms for this exchange that we need a quantum computer to crack that.
Mm.
Now, once we nail it and we actually figure out how to reproduce artificial nitrogenase on demand, well, we're going to change the way we feed the world because we're no longer going to have to spray fertilizers on anything anymore. You'll just put these nitrogenase generators into the soil and they'll keep doing it. It's a good quantum problem, though. And by the way, it's a far easier problem than cracking a 4K key.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 150 qubits we need to pull that one off. So there are important, useful problems for us to solve that will make a difference on this planet with quantum computers.
Wow.
It's just they're not as obvious. Right. We started this conversation with collecting stories. One of my favorite stories. It's a good story.
Nice. And also, if anybody out there is thinking that a qubit is a form of measurement from back in the day, I was with you when I first heard qubit.
Yeah.
It is. It's like biblical or something.
It's Egyptian.
It's Egyptian. Yeah. Okay. So if you're out there and you don't know about quantum computing and you're thinking, qubit sounds familiar, but not quite sure, that's probably where it's coming from.
The Egyptian qubits start with a C.
Yes.
This is a Q and a bit. Right?
Yep.
It's a quantum superposition bit.
Yeah, just for anybody out there, if you were confused.
So right now we're sort of playing in the 3 to 5. Some folks they have a dozen qubits working together, mm-hmm. and they're starting to experiment with a few of the Schur equations to show that they actually work. Quantum annealing has a large number of bits, but the way that it does its resolution isn't as useful for those classes of problem. When we get over 100, important things will start to happen.
Wow.
But it's not going to be like a general purpose.
No, it's not going to replace your smartphone.
Yeah. Or, you know,
or like just computers or like. Or
but, you know, we thought that about the computer. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's true.
Yeah, I may be completely wrong.
Yeah.
Who we don't. The problem is we can't envision the computing problem right now, mm-hmm. right? You know, they talk about the 1930s World's Fair in Chicago, where they talked about television, telephones, you know, telephones with screens and flying cars and so forth. And they don't talk about computers at all.
Right.
Because they didn't exist yet. And they don't talk about the internet at all, because how would you think of that, right? Like, we have huge gaps in our knowledge about what's possible with these things. So I think we've built an infrastructure on this planet capable of hosting a few quantum computers, right, in the form of cloud and internet. And we're going to throw certain classes of problem at them, and from those will become other potential problems that we can solve. And we'll see where it goes. The decrypting thing's not a big deal. There are plenty of encryption solutions that aren't reliant on primes. We can switch over to Lattice and make that problem go away. That's not the issue. The real issue is there are a ton of complex biological processes that would make a huge difference to society if we could actually understand them. And the machines have a good shot at taking that on.
That's amazing.
It really is. I think it's also pretty awesome. So I know we said geeking out. We geek out about some of this stuff, and then everyday people are leveraging the technology that people like us are going out and building.
Yeah, we're all geeks.
You know, it's crazy, but it's just so many people don't realize that they're working with the cloud every single day. They're interacting with the cloud. You know, it's just, I think it can be kind of too far removed worlds from people who aren't in the technical space, but it's just like real world problems for real world people is what this technology is actually.
But it speaks to this idea of its utility. We work with electricity every day. We just don't make a big fuss about it. It's a utility.
Until you don't have it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
No. Until you don't have it. And then you realize every bit of importance of having electricity.
Yeah, my life is remarkably dull without electricity. Goodness gracious. Right? And I have two daughters who grew up with multiple interconnections their whole lives because I was always experimenting on the leading edge of that. The only time the internet was down was they hadn't done their chores. And I actually had an incident where we had a truck back into the pole out front of the house, which is where all the internet connections went through. So then the internet was actually down, and they came downstairs and was like, did we do something wrong?
I remember you had a closet down in the basement, right, with all the servers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, wait.
You have
so
a little
funny.
Cloud in your house?
Yes, I do, actually.
Yep.
But it's not an Azure stack. I asked Jeff Snow where I could have one. He didn't want to give me one.
That's hysterical.
But a number of years ago when VMs got really serious, I redesigned my local server stack to make a transportable VM. So I just get into this idea of I don't care what machine any given instance is running on. It just floats between them. It's a good way to learn, right, to experiment with all of that. But all that stuff's coming up under warranty again. I did a fan swap and replaced all the drives to keep them alive longer. But it's like at some point, it's like, dude, why are you paying for this stuff?
Pull the plug.
You know, there's this thing called
Bitcoin mining, maybe?
Yeah. Well, they always, you know, it's like the cobbler's son has no shoes. Like,
yeah.
I'm that guy. It's like, yeah, still running an exchange server. And like, why? Is this because I like to be afraid? Like, I don't know.
Living life on the edge.
Yeah, that's it.
So what's next for you, Richard? What are you looking at doing next?
I have been for the past year and a half researching the details of the history of .NET.
Mm.
So I realized a few years ago that, you know, it's been 20 years since .NET was gestating the initial thoughts, and if we don't write it down soon, we're going to lose it. And so I tested some audiences, and I've done a few talks that are available online. You can see where I was doing early versions of it. But now I've got dozens of hours of interviews with folks that worked on .NET, from Scott Guthrie, who everybody knows, to someone maybe like Mayoni Stevens, who to this day still works on the garbage collector and is a genius, but Amazing. Most people don't know her name. Which is too bad because she's stunning. Just a remarkable person.
And I feel like you need to explain what garbage collectors are to some people. It probably means, I know what it means, but for some people, it's like, what?
Well, it's a way we manage memory and a different way of managing memory. But when you talk about the history of .NET, there's this time when there was a big argument about garbage collected versus reference counted memory. And that was a part of the debate that became .NET. It was quite controversial to go to garbage collected memory. This is part of what I think is fun about putting the story together. So I'm hoping by the end of this year, I'll get it done. And it's been a delight for me, but you know, I've found that you can't finish a book until you hate it. I don't hate it yet, but I'm getting there.
You are definitely the right person to write that kind of book.
I feel like I'm the right person in the right place for that. And it's been really fun to gather all the interviews. So
it's amazing.
Hopefully I can do it justice. It's a big story.
Thank you for doing that. Cause I know a lot of us who are going to consume that are going to be thankful we didn't have to do the research because we probably never would have learned that stuff otherwise. You know,
when I was testing it on different audiences, obviously all .NET people love to talk about this, but new Microsoft employees were on me. Like, I had no idea that's how that happened.
We just talked about that. We just talked about how do we bridge the gap between people who are born in the cloud educated.
Sure.
To understand, like, what's the legacy like? Because we want to be able to connect with people that are still trying to make a journey to the cloud. So how do you bridge the legacy gap?
And there's still a lot of value. I feel like a lot of times 100%. We are so focused on what is new and we oversee a lot of the reason how we get here and what are all the legacy that have came along with it.
I've often talked in terms of natives versus immigrants. Mm. Okay. So, and it hit me when I remembered my grandmother. I remember my grandmother losing her mind every time I opened the refrigerator. Don't leave the refrigerator open. You'll spoil all the food. Like, close the fridge. I'm like, what are you so uptight about? She was an immigrant to refrigeration. She grew up in a time when they didn't have refrigerators. And so the refrigerator was very different for her. She had a different relationship her entire life with refrigeration than I did as a refrigeration native. Mm. So, I mean, I was only 10 years old when I started playing with microcomputers, but I'm still remember a time before. So my relationship with computing is still an immigrant relationship. And it comes in two forms. I mean, one is you're almost more delighted. Everything is a miracle. You know, where natives often take those things for granted.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying this is good or bad. It's like, what is the difference here? If you've always had it, you only value it. It's like air. You only care about it when you don't have it. Right, and when you know a time before, you have a different relationship with it. I'm wondering if we're on the cusp of a fundamental shift in computing as a whole because the immigrants are retiring. You know, that the folks that come from before that have that, I think, a different level of enthusiasm for certain aspects of it, as they move away and the natives are there, it might be what actually matures our industry.
Maybe, but also if some of that hasn't modernized, how do we have the skill set to know how to translate, you know?
You know, it's funny, you can preserve things remarkably long time. And I would just, you know, as a completely oblique reference, because I thought that steam engine technology was largely lost. Like, who would maintain? And yet, just recently, Union Pacific has successfully restored one of the largest steam locomotives in the world. And it took them 5 years and millions of dollars. And it's an amazing, like, million-pound machine that runs on steam. We'll preserve some of this technology. Like, it's not out of realms. It's also, it's nostalgic, not important.
Yeah, vintage.
Right, and if you go down to the Computer History Museum in San Jose, which Bill Gates has thrown a ton of money at, you know, you'll see they still have an IBM 1401 running, and they have a group of folks who literally are fixing the traces and things
That's
on the
so
electronics.
Cool. I should go check it out.
You should.
It's a 1950s mainframe. So, yeah, I think their legacy, and we should appreciate them, but it's not the driver. You know, the new way of thinking is useful, and it is taking the right things for granted, and I think it is actually what will mature our industry.
Excellent. Wow, this has just been an amazing discussion. Yeah. It's very, very unique, Richard. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights today.
My pleasure.
This has been amazing. Well, that's it. That's a wrap for the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you. and see you next time.